Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
While the government has received most of the praise for its handling of the crisis, it is the Finnish cities and municipalities that have had a key role in Finland's efforts.
What makes a good response? Today we look at some of the better executed reactions that countries around the world have made to the coronavirus pandemic and assess how cities have been at the core of both the fallout and the recovery. From Finland to New Zealand to Greece, we see what has been done right and who we really have to thank. That's all coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. While the coronavirus pandemic has shown both the good and the utterly dreadful when it comes to national government responses, it's often at a city level that real change has been the key to citizen comfort and fight back. We look today first to Finland, whose cities have retained a level of autonomy from their national government when it comes to things like education, healthcare, and social services. This has meant that a truly tailored solution that fits each municipality could be achieved during the pandemic. And it resulted in a staggeringly low death toll compared to their Nordic neighbour to the west. So what is it about these localised efforts that has served the Finns so well? Our correspondent in Helsinki, Petri Burtsov, sent us this report.
On March 17th, the Finnish government, led by the young Social Democrat Prime Minister Sanna Marin, declared a state of emergency over the coronavirus outbreak and invoked extraordinary powers to stop the spread of the virus. Public buildings such as museums, libraries and schools were closed until further notice. Public gatherings of more than 10 people were prohibited, restaurants and bars closed. Borders were closed so that only returning Finnish citizens were allowed to enter the country. The lockdown measures were markedly less strict than those of Italy and Spain, with people still allowed to move freely and see their friends and relatives. Most people shifted to working from home or from their summer houses, but the parks and other popular outdoor areas of cities such as Helsinki were far from empty. Finland's strategy was never to stop the virus completely, like some East Asian countries did, but rather to slow it down while protecting vulnerable groups, such as the over 70s, and safeguarding the capacity of its healthcare sector. The strategy worked. The curve flattened, and to this day, only 300 or so people have lost their lives to COVID-19. This is a remarkably low number by any standard, and particularly so when compared to Finland's similarly sized neighbour Sweden, where the number of casualties was more than 10 times higher. Many factors contributed to Finland's success. Finns in general trust the authorities and follow the rules and regulations diligently. Social distancing was easy for the naturally somewhat reserved Finns. There's a popular joke that after the 2-meter social distancing rule is lifted, people can breathe a sigh of relief and revert back to 5 meters distance that is normal to Finns. Using technology to work and to shop is normal in the country that gave the world Nokia mobile phones and where people were paying their bills online with their phones already in the 90s. Last but not the least, Finland has a large stock of wartime emergency supplies that it has kept replenished due to its unpredictable eastern neighbor. This stock was now opened for the first time since the Second World War, and personal protective equipment was distributed to hospitals and other healthcare institutions. And while the government has received most of the praise for its handling of the crisis, it is the Finnish cities and municipalities that have had a key role in Finland's efforts to combat the pandemic. In Finland, cities and municipalities have a large degree of autonomy and share many responsibilities that in most countries fall under the state's purview. They are in charge of providing services such as healthcare, social services, and education to their citizens. During the pandemic, these services were put under immense stress. Cities needed to redirect healthcare resources in order to care for the COVID-19 patients. City councils were also the first point of call for citizens looking for advice and information. Social services were called upon as cities made sure that the over 70-year-olds were isolated, but that they still received food and medicine. In Helsinki, which recorded nearly half of Finland's coronavirus cases, city officials from various departments were retasked to assist the elderly. As schools closed, it was up to the cities to make sure that the switch to distance learning was seamless and that the technology to establish virtual classrooms actually worked. And while the national level government squabbled over financial support to Finnish businesses, it was the cities that quickly launched programs to support small businesses and entrepreneurs that had suffered because of the lockdown. Like most of Europe, Finland has now moved to the second phase of the pandemic. Life is slowly returning back to normal, with shops and restaurants opening and museums, galleries and libraries opening their doors. There are hardly any casualties anymore, but there is talk of a possible second wave of the virus. Cities are places where people naturally come together, which is why, as Helsinki's mayor Jan Vapaavuori said in his emotional address, they have suffered the most from the social restrictions. This means that cities are also the testbed for the second phase of the pandemic. When cities become cities again, it is up to them to keep track of possible new cases, isolate the infected, and trace the people they've been in close contact with. For Monocle in Helsinki, I'm Petri Burtsov.
Next, we go to New Zealand, a country which has been lauded for its response to the pandemic. New Zealand benefits from a certain level of natural isolation, both between its citizens and from the rest of the world. But with almost 90% of its citizens living in urban centres, the reason the country has been so outstanding in its field is hardly because its residents are all outstanding in their fields. To share some lesser-known facts about the South Pacific nation and why these factors could be the key to their swift and steady-handed reaction to the global pandemic, we enlisted the help of the New Zealand journalist Laura Walters, who sent us this report.
Aotearoa, the Māori name for New Zealand, roughly translates to the long white cloud. And that's exactly what you see flying into the country. But as you break through the layers of cloud descending towards the runway, you're not met with skyscrapers and motorways. Instead, green as far as the eye can see. This abundance of space has given the country its reputation as a picturesque haven, as Middle Earth. It's also helped New Zealand mount one of the world's most effective responses to COVID-19. The nation is comparable in size to Britain, but home to fewer than 5 million people. And while many still live in rural areas, almost 90% now live in cities and urban centres. But even as Kiwis move away from the city, they stubbornly hold on to the quarter-acre dream. For those on the outskirts of a major centre, that could mean a true quarter-acre lot, complete with a few sheep and a couple of cows. In the centre of Auckland and Wellington, families settle for big backyards with a trampoline and a dog. Even inner-city apartment buildings often drop away by the tenth story, and while this style of living is becoming more popular with students and young professionals, they're never far from a bushwalk or a waterfront park. This lack of density and distance from global cities has given people natural insulation from the transmission of COVID. Social distancing comes easy when you have a spacious backyard and live on a street with wide footpaths, in a neighbourhood with a large supermarket you can drive to once a week to collect your groceries. Kiwis were already used to being together, apart. As much as New Zealand is known for Lord of the Rings or rugby, it's known for its sheep. Last count put the population at 39 million. When I was growing up, there were roughly 12 sheep for every person. This piece of trivia was so well known, an international student once asked me where I kept my 12 sheep. What's less well known is New Zealand also has one of the world's highest rates of car ownership. Almost 40% of Kiwi families own two cars, with the total number of motor vehicles surpassing 4.3 million in 2018. This love of the motor car is less whimsical than the idea of every person owning a dozen sheep. It's also less fitting with the country's so-called clean green image, so it's no surprise we don't brag about it. But the silver lining to the country's lack of reliable public transport systems and excessive car ownership meant easy access to what is effectively a motorised safety pod during the lockdown. That's not to say there haven't been carless innovations. With Auckland's central streets largely emptied of Ubers and Audis throughout the pandemic, planter boxes and a lick of paint have been fashioned into temporary cycle lanes and wider footpaths. New Zealand was the first country to set up a dedicated tactical urbanism fund to create immediate temporary social distancing solutions, and the government is footing 90% of the cost. While densely populated urban centres no doubt act as petri dishes, it takes more than space to keep the virus at bay. New Zealanders have the physical landscape to socially distance, but were only ever going to do so if they understood what social distancing looked like and why it mattered. Effective leadership and communication from Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern did exactly that.
We are still in the position of being able to contact trace everyone who is attached to a case, getting them to self-isolate, stopping the spread. But in order to keep successfully doing that, we need to be one step ahead every time and make it easier for us to contact people.
Director of New Zealand's Centre for Sustainable Cities, Philippa Howden-Chapman, says geography and city design played a part in the country's successful response to COVID. But the main thing preventing the spread was Ardern's decisive leadership, which was based on sound science. This approach helped the government retain high levels of public trust and cooperation throughout the crisis. During the pandemic, Ardern referred to New Zealand as a team of 5 million.
And this is why it is a collective effort and why we're a team of 5 million.
A team that prided itself in rising to the crisis and pulling together, apart. Kiwis are cautiously elated, with hospitals waving goodbye to their last COVID patients and the number of active cases hitting zero. But now we need to ask, can we afford for New Zealand's success to play into the growing anti-density sentiment? There was finally an acceptance that urbanisation, rather than sprawl, would play a large part in addressing the country's housing crisis in a climate-conscious way. As New Zealand embarks on an ambitious house-building programme and major infrastructure projects post-COVID, it's in a position to create future cities with climate change, dynamism, and pandemics in mind. Cities that are not only safe, but project a feeling of safety to keep people from fleeing to the countryside in search of a quarter-acre sanctuary.
That was the New Zealand journalist Laura Waters, and our thanks to her. Now, as you know, over the past few weeks, we've been unpacking how the pandemic first forced cities into lockdown and then prompted change in people's lifestyles. Earlier, I was joined by Monocle's deputy editor, Josh Fennett, and Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Ramella, to talk about some of these fundamental changes to our urban environment. Chiara started by talking about the case of Italy as it starts to reopen its borders to tourists.
It's interesting, Andrew, because whilst at the very beginning of restrictions being lifted, there was clearly a lot of scepticism in terms of how quickly life would be able to return to normal. Ever since restaurants reopened, bars reopened, life has really re-accelerated to its pace incredibly rapidly, actually. You know, restaurants reopened in May 18th in Italy, and right now there's conversations about even nightclubs reopening from June the 15th, with space outdoors, for example, cinemas, theatres. And if you look at life on the Italian streets, for what I can see filtered via the newspapers and my own friends' accounts, it very much feels like people have been quite keen on returning to the habits they had completely locked away during lockdown. So I think that whilst obviously it's important that the Italians had to face a number of issues that were a part of their cities before this happened, I'm not sure they've really foregone their urban lifestyle altogether. The problem of small villages being all but uninhabited on, for example, the Italian mountains or just really isolated rural locations has been one that's been going on for a very long time. There have been a number of measures that the Italian government has tried, including, for example, selling houses for something as meagre as maybe a euro, knowing that they would have to be completely repurposed for inhabitation. There's definitely a problem of rural depopulation, but that's a structural systemic problem. And thinking that what would fix it is just 2-3 months of people's wanderlust because they were stuck indoors. I think that's wishful thinking. We do need to think about repurposing our rural space, but that needs to come accompanied by services, by making these places people that we want to live with, the amount of commodity that comes hand in hand with what we are used to as urban living. So I don't think the Italian city concept is really going to go anywhere. Whether this is a situation to rethink public transport and to rethink the way that we have greenery in our cities, then I think that's a relevant conversation. But I'm not sure we will see a complete exodus to the countryside just yet.
No, I think we're going to see shifts, maybe not as dramatic as people predicted. There will be shifts, that's for sure, but nowhere near as extreme as some of the futurologists would have us believe. And interestingly, I bumped into a friend who has a house here in the countryside where they spent much of their life. And a couple of weeks into the lockdown, found a policeman knocking on their front door because the neighbours had dobbed them in and said, we don't want these people from London down here. Can you see if you can go and get rid of them? Now, I think that the idea that Londoners are just going to pitch up in the countryside suddenly saying, oh, we're over city life, we want to live your genteel country life. I think there's also the fact that lots of people in those rural settings aren't that ready for it either. They want their communities to grow naturally, bit by bit. They don't want an exodus from the cities either. Josh, when we come to talk about the city, we often think these changes happen overnight, that they're swift, and especially during the pandemic, many of those changes were overnight. You know, cities locked down, people disappeared from the streets. But actually now, as we go back into a more kind of middle ground, do you think the cities are going to change, or are the changes again going to be structural, complicated, take more time to bed in than people have been saying?
Very good question. I'd love to know definitively all of those answers, but I'll take a punt at it. I think the interesting thing that happened is that cities changed to become unrecognisable overnight in ways that people never imagined that they would. You know, some of the scenes of empty cities, of people locked up in their homes, of people who thought their work commute was the most important thing in the world, and it just ground to a halt. And I think that is a test of our imagination as well. People have been able to look at cities and say, hey, I think this could be pretty different, or hey, my house isn't that big or impressive. Maybe I could do with moving to the countryside. But as Chiara and you have alluded to, I don't know if people want to buy into that vision long term. And I think some things will return as usual. You know, remember when we used to debate about whether electric scooters were a good idea or needed regulating? Remember when we wondered if mass tourism was a bad idea? Remember all of those things? They're still there. They're still problems with our cities. And as we slowly creep back into our offices and in continental Europe, as those borders begin to open and people are able to move around their countries as well as their cities, we're going to get back to a place where we need to deal with these problems. So the response is going to be two speed. I think if you want great urbanism, if you want green parks, if you want mountain bike tracks around your city, if you want great substations that you can walk on the roof of, if you want clean waterways, unfortunately, those things don't come quickly. They need to be done over time. Money needs to be spent on them and consultations need to be done. But if I'm going to strike a more positive note, some of the smaller changes, I guess, that are more software than hardware to people's attitudes, this idea of what makes a good neighbourhood, why it's important to have a good street as well as a good building that you live in, and some of those other aspects like, I don't know, taking responsibility for the few feet or metres in front of your house. Hopefully those little changes will stick because of this huge disruption to urban life. But I think we need to continue investing in density, in better cities, in more beautiful cities, and in cities that work for more people from different backgrounds and with different spending power as well. Those are going to be the big systemic things which need to take place over a much, much longer timescale.
Monocle's deputy editor Josh Fennett and our culture editor Chiara Romella. Finally, to Greece, a country that you may have expected to perform poorly in tackling coronavirus, considering the massive cuts to healthcare spending resulting from the 2008 economic crash. But Greece is, in fact, a positive outlier when it comes to containing the virus's spread. And they managed this result through a strict and stoic lockdown, with minimal quarrelling between leaders. Athens-based journalist Anastasia Miari brings us this report on the members of the Presidential Guard who pride themselves on perseverance and symbolise both the Greek national identity and the country's response to the coronavirus pandemic. Let's listen in.
Outside the parliamentary building at Athens Syntagma Square, tourists usually gather to watch the parliamentary guards stand still as statues. The changing of the guards happens every hour, involving a slow, synchronised choreography of high kicks, their stockinged legs and pom-pommed feet trained to the precision of those belonging to a ballet dancer. Since COVID-19 struck and Greece began shutting the nation down on February 27th, the numbers of tourists and passers-by have sadly trickled down to zero. Still, the choreographed march happens on the hour, every hour. The Evzones, as they are known here in Greece, have served as the parliamentary guard since 1974. On any day of the week, through torrential downpour or searing midday heat, they can be found solemnly staring into the distance, at the presidential mansion or at the tomb of the unknown soldier, a symbol of every man that has fallen defending the nation. Although first funny to look at in their fez caps, the wide white skirts known as fustanella, and their pom-pommed slippers, designed with a hard sole to smack satisfyingly as they meet the marble pavement, the Evzones have become a symbol of Greek national identity. Their stoic, unflinching faces reflecting the Greeks' unified resolve in the face of crisis. We Greeks just get on with it. The Evzones stand for a Greece that is poised for crisis. As a geographical location, modern history has allowed it very little stability. Tussles with the Ottomans over independence, civil war, wars in the Balkans, World Wars I and II, a far-right military regime in the 1970s, and a more recent crippling financial crisis have left the Greeks ready for problems. The nation is used to pain. It's well-versed in making do. It came as a surprise to some that our COVID-19 lockdown in Athens was eased far ahead of other European nations. In comparison to our neighbours in Italy and their 27,000 deaths, Greece has yet to reach 200. The Evzones might explain how the nation has done so well at curbing the virus. Staring off into the horizon and unable to make eye contact with anyone at all, these guards remain motionless for up to 1 hour at a time. In the 40-degree summer heat, a sweat pours from their brow, a guard is on standby to dab at their foreheads, preventing the salty liquid from interfering with their sombre stares, stretched out over 60 minutes. The training is relentless. After 1 month of standard military training for Greek national service, men as young as 18, chosen for their height, a minimum of 6 feet and 1 inch, and stature, are thrown into perhaps the most torturous 6 weeks of their lives. These guys, then, are the cream of the crop, an elite unit honed to become mentally and physically war-hardy. The term Evzona means well-girt or well-belted. First mentioned in Homer's Iliad in reference to light infantry, it has now come to mean someone well-versed in war. Training doesn't just involve daily 10k runs and athletic exercises, though there's plenty of that as well. To become an Evzona, a Greek soldier must do battle with his own mind. Standing motionless for 64 minutes at a time, 4 times a day, is no easy feat, especially when sleep is limited to just 4 hours, split across an entire 24-hour period. The intense training of the Evzones is to ensure that they are poised for battle always. Similarly, the Greeks ensured that they were ready for COVID-19. Intensive care beds were increased by up to 70% beginning in February, before a single death was recorded in the country. An Evzona's typical first day in training may well involve a test of tenacity, like being asked to stare at a clock or a point on the wall for hours on end, or being made to shave against the grain until their faces bleed. Soldiers are lined up, their bags emptied out in front of them. If they make eye contact with anyone, they're screamed at. Evzonas on duty must make no eye contact at all. If they do, they risk becoming distracted. For 6 weeks of training, then, they deny themselves the most basic of human connections. They look no one in the eye. For many, it's too much. By the end of the 6 weeks of preliminary training, 50% of those recruited to become Evzonas will have already dropped out. Such is the mental toll. Still, those in training choose to be there. They elect to serve as an Evzona, very much like the nation itself elected to risk another financial crisis, shutting down annual carnival celebrations, schools, cafes, bars, and restaurants after just a handful of deaths in early March. There was a sense of patriotism, a quiet understanding that this would be for the greater good of the nation, in spite of the already low infection statistics in comparison to neighbouring Spain and Italy. Like in the role of an Evzona in training, discipline was accepted, taken on the chin. When leaving the house to shop, walk the dog, or go to a pharmacist, we informed the government by text, detailing our addresses and the exact time we left the house. On our state-sanctioned one-hour walk, we were stopped by the police and asked to present our okay from the government in the form of a text message. Taking it on the chin pays off. Known cases of coronavirus in Greece total 2,917 at the time of recording. In the UK, the figure stands at over 275,000. To be an official Evzona and graduate to serving in a blue fez is an honour. It means paying respects to your own nation, something the Greeks evidently are happy to do. An Evzona will be the pride of any Greek parent, sibling or girlfriend. For this, we have history to thank. The Evzonas have always been separate to the rest of the army, an elite force known for their discipline, courage, tenacity. Wearing Greece's national costume, the fustanella, a uniform worn by the Klefts, the men who first joined the struggle for Greek independence in 1821, these soldiers stand for Greek solidarity and resistance. They won fame for their bravery in the Balkan Wars and in the Second World War. Their battle cry, Aera, meaning like the wind, was bellowed fiercely as they swept down on their enemies. During the austerity riots of 2012, the Evzonas on duty at Parliament watched thousands of protesters flood Syntagma Square. One Evzona on duty at the time tells me he saw a tree in his peripheral vision go up in flames. Shortly after, tear gas filled the air, his lungs heaving, his eyes smarting with hot tears. And yet still he stood. He was thinking of his grandfather and the great-grandfather before him, Evzonas who fought and died for Greece in both world wars. This is Greek stoicism. These young men, always poised and dressed for battle, are a symbol of Greeks as we've been shaped by modern history. What's another crisis, on top of all that we've been through already?
The Athens-based journalist Anastasia Miari there. And that's all we have for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, well, here's Jamiroquai with We Can Do It. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.